From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Most of Linda Barry's cartoons are about childhood. Her hit off-Broadway play is about childhood, and so are most of her NPR commentaries. On today's Fresh Air, Linda Barry has a few confessions about her own childhood. Also today, we talk with saxophonist David Sanborn. And in honor of Thanksgiving, rock historian Ed Ward carves up some rock and roll turkeys. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Croatian government says it will support proposals by the United Nations to deploy units of the International Peacekeeping Force in disputed regions of the republic. Pierre Vickery reports that the decision marks a change in policy, since Croatia was originally insisting that the force should only be deployed on the republic's borders with Serbia and Bosnia.
The Croatian Prime Minister, Franjo Gregoric, said Croatia was proposing that demilitarized buffer zones be created east of the regional capital Osijek and in Krajina, where Serbs have declared autonomy. A government spokesman said Croatia would still insist on the complete withdrawal of the Yugoslav army and would demand that international forces police Croatia's pre-war borders with Serbia and Bosnia. The Serbian government has rejected any role for the United Nations in its disputed territories of Kosovo and Sanjak, saying the force should only police existing battle lines inside Croatia. Talks on a possible UN deployment will resume over the weekend, probably in Geneva. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
The Prime Minister of Cambodia has apologized to the leaders of the rebel group, the Khmer Rouge, following the attempted lynching of a Khmer leader earlier this week. The Khmer Rouge have joined with the government and several other rebel factions in a coalition of national unity as the country prepares for United Nations-sponsored free elections. The BBC's Alexander Thompson reports.
The Khmer Rouge is by far the most powerful of the Cambodian guerrilla factions, but despite extensive support from China and sanctuaries in Thailand, it was unable to defeat the Cambodian government by force of arms. One reason for that was a lack of widespread support inside Cambodia, a country it terrorized when it was in power. Some estimates say as many as 1 million people died under the extremist regime. But although there were many victims, some, mainly poorly educated peasants, benefited, and the Khmer Rouge has been trying to use such people to recreate a political base. Diplomats in Phnom Penh say the Khmer Rouge is now working to a long-term political agenda and is actively trying to win hearts and minds. But its main population base, the refugees it controls in its camps in Thailand, remain largely unenthusiastic.
The BBC's Alexander Thompson. Syria accused Israel today of trying to block the Mideast peace process by seeking a delay in the next round of talks. The talks are scheduled to begin next Wednesday in Washington, D.C., and Syria said it would attend whether Israel sends representatives or not. Israel had asked that the talks be postponed until December 9th, but an aide to Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir hinted today that there might be room for a compromise. The United States called the next meeting after Israel and the Arabs failed to agree on a time. This is NPR. The space shuttle Atlantis had to steer out of the way of a piece of Soviet space debris today. The maneuver was completed more than 10 hours before the space vehicle would have passed close to the debris, a chunk of a Soviet rocket. It was the second time in the past 3 months that a shuttle has been forced to change course to avoid space junk. NASA rules stipulate that the shuttle should fly no closer than 1.6 miles above or beside another orbiting object. Shortly after the maneuver, the six astronauts settled down to a Thanksgiving dinner consisting of pre-cooked turkey and gravy. As UPI's Rob Navius reports, they also had a holiday greeting for their colleagues at Mission Control.
Atlantis' astronauts spent a workmanlike Thanksgiving in orbit conducting experiments and cleaning up some loose water in their mid-deck area. They also had a chance to send holiday greetings to their colleagues at Mission Control in Houston.
Atlantis, Houston, we're back with you. I'm going to turn it over to Jim. We just want to wish you a good holiday up there in space.
I Hey, that was super. Thanks.
The flight of Atlantis is scheduled to end next Wednesday with a landing here at the ship's Florida spaceport. Rob Navius at the Kennedy Space Center.
Haiti received its first shipment of fuel today since it was placed under an economic embargo by the Organization of American States. Western diplomats said the oil was delivered from a refinery in Aruba, a Dutch colony that doesn't belong to the OAS. The shipment was believed to have been arranged by a Swiss or German company. Officials said the tanker load was enough to support Haiti's needs for another 2 weeks. The embargo was imposed by the OAS in an effort to force Haiti's military rulers to reinstate Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the country's first democratically elected president. Haiti's provisional government announced today that elections to replace Aristide will be held in early January. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We have something special for the holiday. On a recent trip to Seattle, I had the chance to interview someone I had never met but felt as if I already knew. You may also feel as if you know cartoonist and writer Linda Barry, because in her commentaries on Morning Edition, she's revealed so much about herself. She's told us about growing up in a half-white, half-Filipino home, having a father who left the family, getting into scrapes with her brother, and buying an old accordion so she could learn to play duets with her boyfriend. One of the subjects she's funniest and most perceptive about is childhood. Her weekly comic strip, Ernie Pook's Comique, which is carried by 60 papers, is about two sisters, Marlis and Maybone. Barry's off-Broadway hit, The Good Times Are Killing Me, was about the friendship between a black girl and a white girl. The show just closed. Now Barry is turning the story into a screenplay. In September, I interviewed her at the First United Methodist Church in Seattle during an evening sponsored by member station KPLU. Seattle is where Linda grew up, and about 800 of her fans and friends showed up to hear what she had to say.
This is like one of those things, you know, where like I keep thinking I'm in a coma in a hospital because this is just what I dream of. And then I was in this church, and I was next to Terry Gross, and there were all these people clapping when I walked on.
You know, when I read your comics, I always wonder, like, how autobiographical is this? And I keep thinking, oh, all these things couldn't possibly have happened to one person in one life. So how much of it is autobiographical?
I'd say that it's probably 10%, sometimes zero at minimum, mostly 10%. Two, it can be a lot more than that. But it can, from zero to 60.
I wanted an empirical answer to this, yeah.
But because for me, it's sort of like, I think that I was thrilled by the fact that fiction was like lying, which I loved doing when I was a kid. I was fascinated with the fact that you could lie. And I was also fascinated with testing the boundaries of how far you could lie. Like in second grade, I told my classmates that I could control bees with my mind. And thinking that if you say, and also the power of the word, if you say it, will it become true? The answer is no. And that was too far. I had to stand up in front of the class in my most shameful moment and admit, no, in fact, I could not control bees with my mind. And write it 100 times, I cannot control bees with my mind, I cannot control bees with my mind. But fiction has that quality of lying, and as an adult, you get paid for it. It's fantastic. So what I do is I'll take a little bit of the truth, like a cutting from a plant or something, and then just grow a big funky tree from it, you know? The hard part for me is sometimes the things get very real when I'm writing them. And then I do have a hard time remembering what really happened to me and what didn't. It's like when you tell a story over and over and over again, an argument you had with somebody where you weren't as smart as you would have liked to have been. But between the drive from when you had the argument to when you get home to your buddy and you tell them the story, you've actually become very smart. And I told them off. And so it's like that.
You've said that your mother lacked a concept of an American childhood. What did you want her to do that other mothers did that she didn't quite get?
I wanted her to take me to J. Jacobs and get me the biggest bell bottoms that ever were made. I wanted bell bottoms and I wanted long hair. I wanted her to dress me up like the modest hippie in the world. And so it may have been that she didn't lack an American childhood. It meant that she had common sense. But you're not wearing those bell bottoms. I mean, I wanted to look like I was on Hullabaloo at all times, you know? And so there's that. And then also, it is difficult coming from a background that's different than the American, than a regular American background. It's really difficult. In Filipino culture, adults don't speak to children first. Children are supposed to speak to adults first. So my friends were supposed to greet my mother and my grandmother first. And in American culture, it's just the opposite. So my friends would come and think, well, why doesn't your mom talk to me? And my mother would be going, what kind of friends do you have? You know, and I'd be, peace, people.
Since there was a lot about American childhood your mom didn't get, were you able to get away with more that way, or was it harder to get away with things?
It was just a real fragmented life. I know that there was a way that I was at home, and then there was a way that I was on the street, and then I discovered the bus, and I found that there was a way I was on the bus, that I could get an all-day pass for 50 cents. And my mother is in the audience tonight, and she does not know this. And so, Mom, I'm about to tell you, but when I was in the fifth and sixth grade, I used to get on the bus in the morning on Saturdays and tell my family I was going to someone's house, and I would just ride the bus all day. And I would ride it, and I would ride it down to the post office and get on any bus because I found out it would go to the end of the line and turn around and come back. And that's how I saw the city, all by myself. I was really into doing stuff all by myself, and I would imagine when I got on the bus, people would go, who is that child? Who is that girl still riding the bus all by herself? And
so did you go to extremes to prove that you knew what was happening, knew what was cool?
I definitely had a heavy fantasy life. I mean, heavy, heavy fantasy life where I was constantly imagining. I always wanted to do something every day that no one in the world had ever done. But it didn't matter how small it was. Like, I would take a peanut, open a peanut. No one's ever seen this peanut. And then I would... and then I would write an X on it, like with a flare pen, and then I'd eat it. And then I would walk around the rest of the day just like, yeah. You know? I mean, I was really into that idea, and I used to go to mass by myself. I used to go to church by myself when I was a little kid. My mom would drop me off and walk into church and have that same feeling, you know, like, right, that's right, who am I? You know? And I don't know where it all came from. I mean, I had a heavy, 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 heavy fantasy life.
Well, you mentioned Mass. Maybone in your weekly comic is always saying her Our Fathers and asking God for little favors. Did you pray a lot when you were young?
Yeah, I had a really active relationship with God because I was told when I was really little that God could be in anything, which is a terrifying idea. You know, it'd be like, even spit? It's like, yes. Yes, he can be in anything. And I thought of God as being this thing that could hide in anything and was like constantly like watching you. You know, when people said God is watching you, I never thought it was like God is watching you like the crossing guard is watching you. I thought it was like God is watching you, you know? And so I was constantly making deals with God. I mean, constantly making deals. Deals that I still keep. I remember once there was a sermon in Mass about no one should look at dirty pictures. I sort of liked looking at dirty pictures. I was just like this little kid, and they were interesting to me. And so we were all supposed to stand up and vow that we would never do this. And I was about 9, and I knew that would be a lie. I knew at 9 years old I would be standing up and telling a lie to God in God's house. And so I just mouthed the words. I wouldn't let any sound come out. And I made a deal with God that I didn't know what I was going to do about this problem, but every time I saw a beetle laying on its back, I would turn it over for the rest of my life. And I still do it. If I see a beetle, and my friends think, if I see a beetle, like, where's, you know, praying for me? I'm sort of their saint now. You know, maybe Linda will come along, you know. And so I still do that. I turn the beetles over.
If you're just joining us, we're featuring an interview with cartoonist and writer Linda Barry, recorded at the First United Methodist Church in Seattle. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Back to an interview with cartoonist and writer Linda Barry, recorded in Seattle in an event sponsored by station KPLU.
You've said that most of your friends from the neighborhood didn't go to college.
Yeah.
And that you almost didn't go to college.
Yeah.
Do you often think of who you might have become had you not gone to college and not pursued art?
Well, I don't think there was any way that I wouldn't have gone to college. I just loved school. I still love school. So I think the reason I almost didn't go to college, though, was because I had heard a rumor that you had to have 3 years of a foreign language to get into college. And I never checked this rumor. I just thought, well, it must be true. And so, but I heard there was the Evergreen State College, which was kind of this hippie college back then in Olympia.
Matt Greening went to that college.
Yeah,
right?
Matt went. And I heard they didn't require. And some, you know, I mean, they, you could just get in by taping a Band-Aid on an index card, and, you know, which is not true, but that's what I had heard. And so so I got in, and I had a great time there.
You were studying painting.
Yeah, first I thought, if you're going to pay for school, you should study something you hate so you can get your money's worth. Because I thought, why would you study something you already like and already know how to do? You know, it took me 2 years to figure it out, because that's why you're there, because you're paying, and so you should study something you like. But, I mean, it's like going to a restaurant and ordering the worst thing on the menu, because, so I studied the history of science, you know, and then after 2 years, I started studying painting.
What were your paintings like?
What did I paint? We first had to have, we had to paint in series, and I had never heard of that before. You know, where you take one idea and you make a bunch of paintings about it. So my first paintings, I was very nervous because you had to name what your series was, and there were all these really cute guys, really smart girls from New York, you know, wearing a lot of black and stuff. And I felt sort of like a Hertz rent-a-car kind of person next to these people, you know. So I wanted to pick exactly the right thing. So for some, and everybody was picking really weird topics, so I focused on cords going into outlets.
A series of paintings of that?
Oh, yeah. 10 a week.
Was it different kind of cords, like a toaster oven cord and a hair dryer cord?
And we can hang and drape them in different ways, in the shadows behind them. And I called it erotic space. I was real. I was very real. And then I was dead serious about doing that. And then I started painting a lot of stuff. But those were my first really powerful series.
How did you get from your series on cords and erotic space into cartooning?
I went through a really bad breakup. I was seeing this guy. I was just nuts about him, and he left me for this really beautiful blonde, you know, who was like smart and nice. And my only moment was clogs were in. Remember clogs? And I kicked his car, and so the clog like made a dent, and I was really happy about that. Nowadays, it'd be really hard to put a dent in a Camaro. But so I had insomnia, really bad, horrible insomnia. So I started staying up at night after all my friends were asleep and making these little drawings with words, because I wouldn't call them comic strips because I was still trying to be a fine artist. And if you said you were doing comic strips, you were out. So I was like, drawings with words. And my drawings were of women in bars talking to cactuses, who were the men, and the cactuses would have like a million cigarettes. And the words were that the cactuses wanted the women to go to bed with them. And the women were like, I'm not sure about this. So those were my first, and then I had a friend, John Keister, who was at the University of Washington, and he was working on the Daily, the paper there. And so I was sending them to him in the mail, and he was printing them. And I made up a name, Ernie Pook's Comics, because I didn't want anyone to know they were me. And then that's what happened.
Why didn't you want anyone to know they were you?
So that I wouldn't be kicked out of my powerful series of erotic space, you know. So that wouldn't be lessened, marred by some of the work that I was doing in cartooning.
So what reaction did you get from your painting teachers and fellow painters when they found that it was really you?
They didn't for a long time. I mean, it was a couple years.
Well, you weren't proud enough of the work to
look at? I did a little bit of work in the school paper with Matt Groening, was the editor of the school paper at Evergreen. And I did some work for him and eventually got into it. But it really did mean separating. I mean, at that time, now comics are like fine to do, but This was in 79, and it was, if you did anything funny in artwork, then the value went way down. Half price sale. A joke.
So. There's a cartoon of yours I want to ask about. It's from 1984. It's called Your Naked Body.
Yeah.
And I wrote down some of this. You write, some of us are very proud of our bodies. Others feel shafted. We know how to stand in front of the mirror to make us look perfect in the mirror, but it's hard to stand this way at the beach. Was there a story behind this comment?
It's so funny, because before I was coming here tonight, I was standing in front of the mirror, and I was thinking, well, a simple way to look like you're 5 pounds thinner is, you know, when I was doing all that stuff that only looks good from this angle, and from the side you look like some italic, you know, like, you know, and your double chin won't exist if you hold your head like this. It's completely, and I had this thing where I always felt like I didn't have any nice eyelids, so I always like to lift my eyebrows whenever I would look in the mirror, because I just thought that made me look more attractive, and so I have all these pictures, these photographs from junior high school, and I thought I had really big lips. This is before big lips was like, before they were getting implants in their lips. But I saw this picture of me in junior high school where I'm actually, I look calm, placid, but when I look at the picture, I can see that I'm holding my head this certain way and sucking in my bottom lip so it looks half its size, you know, and thinking, God, oh my God, they'll never know. You know?
Another comic I wrote down part of, this is the morning after going out with a real creep. And so the character's sitting there thinking, and she's waiting for this real creep who she really hates to call because the whole thing's made her so neurotic. And she says, and today I'm going to sit here with my college education and wait for a phone call from a man I never want to see again in my life. So,
and if he didn't call.
Yeah. Let it please be him, oh dear God, right. It must be him.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if your sense of feminism and your sense of romance are ever at odds with each other.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. That's woman's greatest dilemma. If I know this, like, why am I still calling him up? Oh, nothing. Did I leave some lint at your house? I mean, that's the part that I don't understand. I mean, that's the part, that's where you do invoke God, you know, and say, what? I give.
So you're in a relationship now. What kinds of things are at odds in that?
I'm in the early stages. I'm in like the six month heavenly, you know, where everything they do. Tell me that story about how you found a dollar on the floor of a supermarket again. You know, where your friends don't want to hear the word Kevin again, you know? Like, as soon as you say Kevin, you can just see this light go off, and they're going over their laundry list and everything that they have to do, you know? But, yeah, I mean, I'm at that little happy stage. That happy stage where you just think it will last and last and last, and I've found it, and nothing's ever going to go wrong.
In your Ernie Pugh comic, did Marlis fall in love with Kevin Turner at the same time?
Yeah.
You fell in love?
I did. Yeah, I did that. I did that. I put his name in my comic strip to get him to like me more. I put his name so he would like me more, and I thought the readers wouldn't care if his name was Kevin or, you know, didn't matter.
Was Sherman. He impressed with your power?
Oh, yeah. It worked perfectly. It was great.
Your name is spelled L-Y-N-D-A.
Yes.
Now, I have to ask you, when I was in junior high school, my older brother used to say to me, I spell my name T-E-R-R-Y. My brother used to say to me, I should change it to T-E-R-I. That way I could dot the I with a heart.
Oh, yeah. Or a flower.
Or a flower. You know, and kids are so, like, crazy about their name. Did you make up the Y when you were...
During the age of Aquarius. I definitely stuck that Y in.
And what did the Y give you?
Well... The Y gave me this completely groovy symmetry, you know, when you're doing that bubble lettering that all junior high school kids do. There was a Y in my last name, too, and I was just sort of into that. I gave up that I where you could use a heart or a... But I remember I had seen... One of the biggest things that ever happened to me was seeing Hair, the Broadway musical Hair. And I had won... I was really one of those fast callers, be the third caller and you can win, you know, whatever. I won the Thanksgiving turkey for our house for like 4 years because I would hear the gobble and like... be the third caller. And I won the soundtrack to Hair.
And I grew up in my neighborhood, which was, you know, this basically, it was like a very soulful neighborhood. And Black Panther, the Black Panther thing had hit, and there was no way I could be a Black Panther, although I gave it my best. And when I got the soundtrack to Hair, there were these hippie people on it. And I thought, these are my people. This is who I've been striving to use for the bell bottoms. And so I forgot what I was saying because I was so overcome by Hair. What did you ask me? I was like, I just saw the whole musical.
The Y in your name.
Oh, the Y in my name. And so then, no, seriously, I just started seeing the whole thing.
You were distracted by the too.
Right.
Yeah.
I saw it at the Paramount, you know, when Hair came to town, and I knew all the words, and I got so impressed by this. It's still the most powerful thing that I've seen. And after I saw that, I thought, I want to be changed. And so I put the Y in my name and showed them. You know, my social studies teacher, what is this? It's me, man.
You do all these comics about adolescence, but do you relate to kids today? Because I think you're drawing a lot on what adolescence was like when you were young. But when you see kids today, do you really feel like you understand them?
Yeah, I mean, I really relate to them. I have a lot of empathy for them, particularly people going through adolescence, because I think that it's a time, it's almost like there's a mythology about it, and it's a really interesting time in a person's life, and it's a very difficult time. And it's a time when we need our parents more than anything, and we also need to separate from them.
Yeah.
And it's a time when lying starts to be a big thing, because you lie to the authorities, and you also lie to your friends about who you are. So it's a very lonely, difficult, powerful time.
Did you mention you lie to yourself, too?
Yes, and you lie to yourself plenty. And music is really important. You get all your philosophy from the radio. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. You know, taught me how to live. And then, and so I feel a lot, I have a lot of empathy for adolescents in particular, and children too, because they're just in a funny place, but particularly adolescents, because they're held responsible for all their actions, and they're still sort of kids, you know? I mean, you've seen a 16-year-old drive in a car, and they look like they're 9. It's like, what are you doing?
when you and Matt Groening were first friends, and you were first starting out drawing strips and everything, did you think of yourselves as really unlikely candidates for success?
Well, yeah, in a lot of ways. Yeah, I still sort of do that. Matt was, at this hippie college, how Matt was the revolutionary was he was really straight. I mean, straight. You know, he played bridge, and he listened to what I thought was Muzak at the time. Turned out to be Fellini soundtracks, but that's how hip he was. He just listened to the soundtracks that sounded like Muzak, but they were really Fellini. And, you know, so that you don't get it, do you? And, and so, I mean, but you didn't really think about success. You didn't really think about any of that stuff because it just seemed so, couldn't imagine being 30, you know? So
right.
I never really thought about any of that stuff. All I wanted to do, though, was to be able to not have a job. It's like, I really wanted to not have a job, and I've succeeded.
Cartoonist, writer, and Morning Edition commentator Linda Barry, as recorded at an event sponsored by member station KPLU at the First United Methodist Church in Seattle. Our thanks to the staff of KPLU and Scott Geibel of Pacific Lutheran University Audience Services. By the way, Linda Barry has several books of her cartoons and a novel called The Good Times Are Killing Me. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Saxophonist David Sanborn's late, late-night TV show, Night Music, showcased out-of-the-mainstream jazz and rock musicians from a wide range of styles. Sanborn himself has played in many different contexts. He's had a successful solo career, played with Gil Evans, David Bowie, Stevie Wonder, and the Rolling Stones, and he often sits in with Paul Schaefer in the Late Night Band. Coming up, a conversation with David Sanborn. Also for Thanksgiving, rock and roll historian Ed Ward serves up some rock and roll turkeys. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Canoy. A French newspaper said today the Venezuelan-born terrorist known as Carlos has been thrown out of both Libya and Syria. Carlos is one of the world's most wanted men. He's masterminded a number of deadly terrorist attacks since 1985, when he stormed an OPEC office in Vienna and took 70 people hostage. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
The last known attack by Carlos took place in 1984 against a French cultural center in Lebanon. 2 years later, there were rumors that he'd been killed. But a report in the Paris-based newspaper Libération says that on September 21st, Syria's secret border police put Carlos, his family, and three other people on a plane to Libya. The newspaper said Carlos had a diplomatic passport from Yemen and was carrying a suitcase containing two guns, two grenades, ammunition, $1 million, and jewelry. Report said Carlos was stopped by police at the airport in Tripoli, questioned, and then sent back to Damascus. Report was written by a French terrorist expert. It does not give sources for the story. Report says that after Carlos returned to Damascus, Syrian officials put him on a plane to Yemen in the Middle East. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
In the West African nation of Togo, the army launched a coup against the civilian government early this morning. At least 17 civilians have been killed. Soldiers patrolled the streets to stifle any opposition. The army seized government buildings, radio, and television stations. A radio statement from army officials said if the president did not name a new prime minister, the military would reduce the capital city to ashes. Croatian officials have accepted a United Nations proposal for peacekeeping troops in disputed sections of the republic. Croatia had demanded the patrols mark the republic's pre-war boundaries to assure it would not lose territory. Kathy Jenkins reports from Zagreb.
The Croatian Prime Minister, Franjo Gregoric, said Croatia was proposing that UN troops should patrol a demilitarized buffer zone in the east of the republic and a second zone in the region of Krajina, where Serbian nationalists have declared themselves to be autonomous. The Prime Minister's statement represents a significant shift in Croatian policy and confirms suggestions that Croatia was preparing to compromise over the deployment of peacekeepers. Originally, Croatia had proposed that troops be deployed on its existing borders with Serbia and Bosnia-Herzegovina as a way of trying to ensure that it could regain the territory now under the control of the Federal Army. It claimed that Serbia's proposal that troops patrol along a line formed by the army's new positions would serve the interests of a greater Serbia. For National Public Radio, this is Kathy Jenkins in Zagreb.
An oil tanker docked in Haiti today to offset severe shortages caused by an embargo by the Organization of American States. The ship carried enough gasoline to fill demand for a few weeks. This is NPR. Next week, the United Nations General Assembly begins its annual review of whether to admit South Africa. For about 20 years, the General Assembly has rejected the credentials of South African diplomats. Despite some progress in the country's apartheid policies, it doesn't look like the UN will approve South Africa this year. African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela is expected to speak to the UN. The debate will last 3 days. The U.S., Japan, and the European Community have all lifted trade sanctions against South Africa, but they adhere to international embargoes on oil and arms trade with Pretoria. Officials of the World Health Organization predicted today that the number of AIDS cases worldwide will increase 10 times by the year 2000. From member station WUNC, Adam Hochberg reports.
The head of the World Health Organization's AIDS program says 5,000 people worldwide are being infected every day with the virus that causes the disease. The organization estimates that 1.5 million people have AIDS and predicts the number will rise to about 18 million by the year 2000. The organization has declared Sunday its fourth annual World AIDS Day, an event designed to educate people about AIDS and raise money for the fight against it. Meanwhile, a new federal study concludes that the cost of treating AIDS in the United States will total $5.8 billion this year, and it predicts that cost will nearly double by 1994. For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Hochberg.
Italy joined France and Germany today in their push toward greater political union for the European Economic Community. The EEC summit next month is expected to be a referendum on European federalism. Britain is fiercely opposed. In Bonn today, Italy's prime minister said the summit should launch an irreversible drive to unity. The Soviet foreign ministry plans to shut down several embassies abroad to save money. A spokesperson said today there is no list yet of which missions will be closed. Embassy staff have already been cut back in recent years. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Even if you've never heard any of David Sanborn's solo albums, you've probably heard the alto saxophonist play. He was featured on Stevie Wonder's album Talking Book, and he soloed on David Bowie's hit Young Americans and on James Taylor's How Sweet It Is. You can often see Sanborn on David Letterman's show, sitting in with Paul Schaefer and the Late Night Band. For a couple of years, Sanborn hosted his own late-night TV show called Night Music, which showcased out-of-the-mainstream jazz and rock musicians. Sanborn would often sit in with them. You can hear the results of that kind of eclecticism on his latest album, Another Hand, which is a departure from his previous fusion records. The album was produced by Hal Wilner, who also produced the TV show. Another Hand features Sanborn alongside an interesting range of jazz and rock musicians, including pianist Terry Adams of the witty rock band NRBQ. I asked Sanborn how he decided what to do with musicians like Adams once he invited them to be on the record.
The process was with Terry, as it was with Bill Frisell and Charlie Hayden. I got together with them. In Terry's case, I got together with him up at his house in Woodstock. And we went over some of his material. I talked about what at that point was my idea for the album was kind of do a kind of more low-keyed, atmospheric kind of record, and it's certainly something different than what I had done. And we just went through all his material and found two things that I felt were appropriate for the record.
Well, I think I'll play Hobbies. Do you want to say anything about it?
Hobbies as well. If there was a national anthem for Devil's Island, this would be it.
Hobbies with my guest David Sanborn on alto saxophone. It's from his new album, which is called Another Hand.
Right. That's I think the subtitle of that tune is Holiday in Hell. It's definitely got that kind of slightly twisted twist, I guess you'd say.
Let's talk a little bit about your background. How old were you when you started playing the alto, and what made you choose it?
I was 11 years old, and When I was a kid, I had polio, and when I got to be about 11 years old, the doctors and therapists suggested that I play a wind instrument for therapy, and it was right about that time that I was, you know, starting to kind of really listen to music and know what it, you know, be able to associate a certain sound with a certain musician, and this was in the early days of rock and roll. And rhythm and blues music. So the first music I remember hearing was like Little Richard and Fats Domino. And there was some blues, B.B. King and Albert King, because I grew up in St. Louis. And so a lot of that music was being played on the radio. And I think the music that had the most profound effect on me and probably what really pushed me in the direction of wanting to be a saxophone player was the music of Ray Charles. The saxophone players were kind of like the instrumental counterpart to what Ray was doing vocally, and I just thought it was such a great sound. You know, it was so hip to me.
Mm-hmm. So when you had polio as a child, how bad did it get?
Well, I was in an iron lung for a while when I was like 3 years old, and then I was paralyzed from the neck down, you know, after that for a while, and then I went through therapy, and, you know, I gradually, you know, regained the use of most of my limbs, and the saxophone helped.
How did it help?
Well, it helped strengthen my lungs. It was, you know, that helped strengthen the lungs and the diaphragm. And I think that, you know, one of the things that my parents didn't expect was that it would become a real outlet for me, an avenue for me to express myself, you know, because it became my voice in a way.
My guest is alto saxophonist David Sanborn. He has a new album called Another Hand. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Alto saxophonist David Sanborn is my guest. In 1967, you started playing with the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, which I've come to think of as the blues band for the psychedelic era or something.
Yeah, well, it was kind of one of the only blues bands in the psychedelic era, although the James Cotton was working at the time.
Right.
And Michael Bloomfield was working with the Electric Flag.
Remember those days for us. What it was like for you then, touring with the band?
It was a very exciting time. I mean, you know, we were young and foolish. And we, you know, we were traveling on the road. We, you know, we weren't making a lot of money, but we were working. And there was a lot of exchange among musicians, you know, people hanging out. Jimi Hendrix was around. There was the jazz, the whole jazz scene kind of went underground. The kind of overwhelming influence of electric guitars kind of eclipsed, you know, not only the rhythm and blues music that went before, but also kind of eclipsed the acoustic sound, which included saxophones, trumpets, and what have you. For example, I was one of the only horn players that was working on the scene at that time. You know, I mean, there weren't a lot of horn players working.
After your years with the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, you ended up playing, touring with, I believe, the Rolling Stones and with David Bowie.
Well, I was actually playing with Stevie Wonder in 1971 and 1972, and we were asked to open for the Rolling Stones on the summer of 72 tour, and so I consequently got to play with them, you know, on that tour.
In their band or just opening?
Well, there were a couple of encore numbers where both bands played together.
Right, right. Let me ask you, I had heard a story once about...
About the Rolling Stones?
No, about Stevie Wonder opening for the Rolling Stones and getting booed.
It probably happened, although I don't remember it. I was a little bit under the weather, or over the weather at the time.
Right. Were there things that you were... Were there things that were really fun about, you know, like a Stevie Wonder Rolling Stones tour, and on the other hand, things that were really alienating about it?
Well, it was certainly exciting. You know, I mean, there was a lot of... It was a lot of intense behavior. I don't know how else to put it. It was pretty, I guess you would say, Dionysian. it seemed very, it, it was I'm trying to think of all the words that I can to describe it. You know, like it was uninhibited kind of behavior that went on. And I mean, in a sense, that was kind of fun. You know, I don't think it, you know, I think what happened with me and a lot of other people is it almost killed us. You know, and I don't see how they survived it, but somehow they did. You know, I think they kind of existed in the calm center of the storm. You know, and people, you know, the storm was raging all around them, and a lot of people got thrown off, kind of, burned out. So it was exciting. I mean, I saw a lot of things that I'd never seen before.
Like what?
Well, I think just amount of just crazy behavior, you know. A lot of sexual activity, a lot of drugs. You know, not so much with them, but with the people that were around them, you know, the kind of entourage, the people that, you know, the thing that I always noticed about the Rolling Stones is that they pretty much, you know, in spite of everything, took care of business. And they may have partied heavy, but certainly not as heavy as the people around them. You know, the hangers-on, the sycophants, you know, all the people that were in the periphery, on the periphery of that.
How did you start recording solo albums?
Well, after I played with David Bowie, I was working with David Bowie, and I was also working with Gil Evans at the same time.
Now, that's an interesting juxtaposition, because Gil Evans was one of the great jazz arrangers.
Yes.
And David Bowie, a big rock star. So there's two different...
Well, I know that one of the oddest situations I can remember was I played the last show of Bowie's tour was in Madison Square Garden. And I played the show in Madison Square Garden and left there, got on a plane and flew to Italy. And the next day, I was in Perugia, Italy, playing with Gil Evans. And that was, the juxtaposition of that was very odd.
You know, I know you played off and on with Gil Evans for several years.
Yes, I did.
I saw you once with him at a small club in New York, and this was in the early 80s when, I mean, your solo albums, as I believe, were selling quite well then. Mm-hmm. So, obviously, you weren't sitting in with him for the money.
No.
Why did you want to keep playing with Gil Evans, even though you were having your own successful solo albums and you'd done quite well playing on rock records?
Well, it was such a great experience playing with Gil. I mean, he was, you know, one of the great arrangers of jazz and certainly this century. To me, I can think of so many great things about Gil's music, you know, and it was like when you were playing in the ensemble, every part was like a melody, and so you kind of wanted to play, and the you know, you felt like, you know, the part you were playing was so melodic, yet it fit with everything else that was going on. And I don't think to my ears, there was never an arranger that had, you know, that kind of ear for color and texture and the atmospherics as Gil.
You told us earlier that you first started playing the alto as therapy for your polio. Do you have any after effects from the polio now?
Well, I have. I don't have total use of my left arm, and I have some problems in my right leg.
Does your left arm interfere with playing?
Well, I don't have total flexibility in my left hand, so I mean I have problems with certain technical problems with the instrument.
Fingerings?
Yeah, certain fingerings, and I have to kind of lean a certain way to play, which is, it's funny because I saw a young player who was like kind of imitating me, imitating my sound, and I saw a picture of him and he was standing like me, and with his little finger kind of thrown up, which is the way I do, but it's not because I want to do that. It's because my little finger just does that. And he kind of stood crooked. And, you know, I wanted to find him and tell him and say, look, you know, if I could stand straight while I played, I would.
Right.
You know, and I wouldn't throw my little finger up like that if I could do it. So it was just kind of odd that, you know, so I'm imitating my, you know, my compensating characteristics.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Alto saxophonist David Sanborn. His latest album is called Another Hand. This is Fresh Air. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Today on All Things Considered, a Senate Foreign Relations Committee report on the conditions of Iraqi Kurds, a new shot for chickenpox. It doesn't prevent the disease, but it makes it a little less serious, and a report on the people who blew the whistle on the nuclear weapons plant at Rocky Flats in Colorado. We'll also have some Thanksgiving stories. Bailey White tells one, I tell one, and we'll hear from you and your letters. We also have a celebration of the 50th anniversary of Gourmet Magazine. Happy Thanksgiving is coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. How did a noble bird like the turkey wind up as a slang term for things preposterously awful? Our rock and roll historian Ed Ward says he doesn't know, but on this Thanksgiving Day, his mind has turned to rock and roll turkeys.
Turkeydom is a product of the late 60s, right around the time when the Beatles broke up. At that point, the industry decided that there was going to be a giant hole in the rock universe, a hole that could be filled by a group that was significant, tasteful, and that spoke directly to the kids. And so the hype machine went to work. Now, sometimes hype would go awry on a perfectly innocent band. Take Kippington Lodge, which had just changed its name to Brinsley Schwartz after its guitarist and signed to a major label. The label hired a company called Fame Pushers Limited to fly a plane load of British journalists to New York to see Brinsley Schwartz play the Fillmore East. The band was hardly ready for such star treatment, but the problem was compounded by the fact that Fame Pushers didn't give the journalists any time to deal with jet lag before the show, not to mention that it had been an awful flight, and New York in midwinter is hardly paradise. Only because Brinsley Schwartz was as good as they were did they survive the beating they took. More often, though, it was the bands themselves who took their own press too seriously and became ponderously significant. Occasionally, it was out of desperation. The Electric Prunes, a bunch of guys hired to fulfill a contract when the actual band, the Electric Prunes, broke up, recorded David Axelrod's Mass in F Minor in 1967. It remained a low point in Catholic liturgy until 1970, when the British band Spooky Tooth joined French electronic composer Pierre Henry and recorded Ceremony, a Requiem Mass. Finally, in 1971, Leonard Bernstein proved with his classical rock fusion Mass that it wasn't only the rockers who were confused. The classical rock fusion, in fact, provided hours of excruciating listening. Not only was there Emerson, Lake, and Palmer doing violence to the classics, but there were also such monstrosities as Deep Purple's 1970 Concerto for Rock Band and Orchestra, undertaken with the Royal Philharmonic. And who could forget Procol Harum live in concert with the Edmonton Symphony Orchestra, try as one might. Then there were bands like Ars Nova and the New York Rock and Roll Ensemble, who were neither classical nor rock, nor popular, nor interesting. But where classical music and rock really produced turkeys was with the rock opera. The rock opera was born when Pete Townshend of The Who announced in 1966 that he was writing an opera for the band. When it failed to appear immediately, somebody named Keith West got to work and released a single entitled Excerpt from a Teenage Opera. It sank without trace, and fortunately the rest of the opera never appeared either, although unfortunately The Who did come out with Tommy in 1969. Pretentious, padded, and loaded with histrionic moments for Roger Daltrey, it's still the best rock opera. Of course, the competition includes such horrors as a rock opera of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, featuring Richard Burton and Thin Lizzy's Phil Lynott, Percy, a rock opera by the Kinks about the world's first penis transplant, Everything by Andrew Lloyd Webber, and The Who's other rock opera, Quadrophenia, which was at least a good movie. But leading the list of rock opera turkeys has to be The Naked Carmen, starring Melba Moore, a now-forgotten band called Pig Iron, the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, and a children's tap dance troupe from Harlem, all doing a rock reconceptualization of Bizet's poor opera. Elaborately packaged and utterly unlistenable, it stood out even in 1970s Turkey Parade. And what about supergroups? Blind Faith broke up almost as soon as it debuted, leaving the field open for such lawyerly-sounding outfits as Souther Hillman and Furay, or West Bruce and Lang, or Bogart Beck and Apice. Right down to today's Damn Yankees, featuring Ted Nugent, Tommy Shaw from Styx, and some guy from Night Ranger, the one thing you can count on from a supergroup is that it sure won't be super. How about Super Hypes? Remember Joe Bryath? A true fairy, the ads said, but he still failed to become America's gay superstar. Or Klaatu, the mysterious band Capital never quite came out and said was the reunited Beatles, mostly because anybody could tell from their album that they weren't. And who could forget Pink Lady, the Japanese duo who were going to conquer America with their charm, their singing, their dancing, their television show, everything, in fact, except the English language, which nobody had taught them. Oh, speaking of Japan, let's thank them for making available once again on a single CD Lou Reed's notorious turkey, Metal Machine Music, over an hour of a single harsh grating sound. And if the inside of Metal Machine Music was bad, the outside of Vinnie Riley's The Return of the Daruti Column album was worse. It's made of coarse industrial sandpaper and destroys any album it's stored with. In fact, eventually it destroys itself with stray pieces of grit from its cover. But Thanksgiving is about more than turkey. It's about giving thanks. And today, I've given each and every one of you something to give thanks for. I haven't played you a note from any of these albums. Out of deference to your appetite, I won't either.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. Well, Ed meant well in sparing us, but since we've got the last word and we happen to have The Naked Carmen, we're going to play it for you. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Roberta Shurrock, Sue Weinstein, and Sue Spolin. Research assistants from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross. We all wish you a happy holiday.
One, two, three.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In some churches, the saxophone is thought of as the instrument of the devil. Bernard Johnson uses his saxophone to play gospel music and praise the Lord. On the next Fresh Air, the playing and preaching of Bernard Johnson. Also, we meet celebrity photographer Annie Leibovitz. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.